John Ferraro has enjoyed a panoramic drumming career that has allowed him to become a first call A-list session drummer. And that doesn't happen overnight. From his early tours and sessions with Larry Carlton and Barry Manilow, to playing with Boss Gags, Burt Bacharach, and so many others, John has earned his stripes, has garnered respect among his peers in the music industry, and he's created a long-lasting career in music. John's journey continues, and we're very pleased to finally have him on to talk about his amazing career. Inside Music Cast welcomes John Ferraro. Hey, John, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure. It's quite an honor to be asked to be on the show today, and I'm really excited to spend the next little bit with you guys.
Yeah, we're glad to have you.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, John, like Rick said, it's good to have you on. It's very long overdue. In fact, I think as we just talked a couple minutes ago, I think I've been chasing you for 2 or 3 years. I mean, that's almost scary to say that in today's society, isn't it?
That's true. I know everything's so instantaneous with texting and instant messenger that, you know, it happens so fast.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. Thank you for pursuing that and staying on it, Eddie. That's great. I'm honored to be here.
By the way, you're our first interview for the new year. So happy new year.
And happy new year. Happy new year to you and all our listeners from around the world.
Exactly. First interview of the year, 2019, and with John Ferraro. You know, as me and Rick were sort of browsing through a lot of videos and material that you are credited on and have performed on, and, you know, we just started stumbling on stuff. And, you know, we sort of threw some things to each other, but there's one performance that really surfaced, and it's the one when you're playing with Boz, of course, in 2004 in San Francisco's Great American Hall Music Hall. And Boz was, I know you remember it very well, Boz was performing his greatest hits. And and you remember that first track, right?
I believe it's probably Lowdown.
Is it
that
was.
What the show started with? Yeah, of course. Okay.
Yeah, that was one of the most phenomenal beginnings to a show. I mean, just a few bars that groove. And I always go back to that. In fact, one of our correspondents, Scott Gross, just posted as an album review on our Facebook page that same album and that same performance. And you were referenced on that. And it's so memorable. Tell us a little bit, just as before we begin anything, what are your memories on that? On that session right there, because the reason is when you start looking at that legendary LA AOR groove, like the one that's on Silk Degrees, and you play it with such precision, but what is it about that groove that makes it very special, you know?
Well, I'll give you a long-winded answer here. So that song, obviously, you know, heard it on the original recording with basically Toto, you know, one of my all-time favorite drummers, Jeff Porcaro.
Right.
And, you know, just the way all the parts fit together and, you know, it was almost a mandatory thing to want to learn that groove in particular. A lot of the top 40 bands would be playing that song. So, you know, fast forward to 2004, I think, is that what you said? Yeah. And here I am playing it live on that show, or, you know, the taping. It was just almost like it was something that a lot of my contemporaries here in the LA area, you know, had studied extensively. And that was very definitive, all those grooves that were played by Jeff on all those records with Boz.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was almost like a dream come true to say, wow, here I am, you know, sitting in the drum chair playing these songs that I cut my teeth on, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was really fun. And that video, we had taken about a month or so off from touring. We had done a tour around the States, and then we had a break knowing that we were coming back. I think it was in October that was recorded.
Okay.
And that whole weekend, he had it blocked out, and David Page was there to help produce that session.
Mm-hmm.
And before they did the jazz recording with Boz at the time, had sort of a jazz, small group, jazz group that recorded some of the American Songbook stuff. And then the next day was our concert. So it was a really lively audience. Everything was real fresh, you know, for all the players. The sound was great. I've always enjoyed playing at that hall. I think the first time I played there was in 1978 with Larry Carlton.
Yeah.
And that was a thrill. You know, it's just a real classic concert hall building in the Bay Area, in the city, San Francisco. So all those components and everybody being kind of pumped up. I think almost all the things were first take kind of. I don't think we maybe went back to do levels at soundcheck or, you know, the performances, in other words, were all done in front of a live crowd. So it was really a true capture of a live concert. And I can then remember many people, you know, saying, hey, I saw you at Best Buy. I go, Best Buy? What do you mean? Because they were using that disc as a demo in a lot of the stores from all over the country.
Yeah.
So that was kind of funny. I go, oh, really? Well, I haven't even seen it because I don't think they had sent us copies or oftentimes. But somewhere I do have a copy of it. And I, like you said, with YouTube or whatever other media source, people are posting it. And I still get comments to this day about it. So the fact that you guys are bringing it up to me again, it's very, you know, it's held up the test of time. But like I said, it was me trying to do my best to honor that, you know, magical groove that Jeff always had.
Yeah.
Just play the parts with the right type of, you know, sound, attitude.
And feel. So, yeah.
Thank you for the compliment.
Beautiful. Thanks.
You know, you've worked with some great artists and musicians in the course of your career, but, you know, you've also played different forms of performance, you know, studio and touring, of course, we know about theater, film, television, you know, faith and worship, concerts, and several collaborations. So this is probably not a fair question, but do you favor one over the other? Maybe you like one aspect more than the other, and or is the variety important to you and from your experience?
That's a great question. Wow. I'll start with something that's kind of humorous. When I was dating my wife, you know, we'd go out to different places to eat, and she was always intrigued, like, wow, we're going to this Thai restaurant. Now we're going to a Japanese. Now we're having Italian. Now we're going to have this.
Yeah.
So the quote or the takeaway, which ties into your question, was the variety.
Yeah.
So she goes, you really like variety. So I would have to say that that's been a calling card in a sense that, you know, when I introduce myself to my neighbors or somebody you meet and you say, I'm a drummer, oh, what band are you in? And
right.
then it's always like, well, I'm not in a band, but I always tease them and say, well, if you have a TV or a radio, you've heard me play a number of times. They're like, really? Well, what song? So, well, it could have been a commercial. It could have been an actual song. So the idea that, and I always try to tell students that and parents, you know, like there is sort of a career path as a musician without having to be in a famous band.
Right.
And people, it's a little hard to understand. And then you brought up the point of like the worship, praise and worship. Well, there's a number of churches all over the world that have full-time music pastors, worship leaders, youth music leaders. So that's a tremendous opportunity, which for when I was growing up, I wasn't even aware of it until I was in my early 20s. You know, I started doing some sessions for Maranatha and other companies that were making those records. So I try to bring the same enthusiasm, what's the word, like authenticity to whatever that style happens to be. So
you give it your all.
Yeah. It's each thing is a challenge and to, you know, kind of nail it. And part of that, as I'm fortunate to have a pretty extensive, one of my resumes, they call me a drum junkie, but, you know, having the right sound or the right gear and sort of looking at it as almost like wardrobe, you know, you're not going to show up to a wedding wearing a Speedo or, you know, nor would you show up to the beach wearing the tuxedo.
So right, exactly.
Having the right sounding gear, you know, some jazz drums, some rock drums, some, you know, mainstream pop kind of drums and the different cymbals, you know, required for those sounds. That's what keeps it interesting. Like, it's almost like a toolkit if the repairman comes to your house to say, hey, I fixed this. Well, he's got the right tool.
Yeah.
So that's been my approach. I mean, I was fortunate to grow up in an era when I could cut my teeth doing a lot of demo sessions. You know, this is right prior to the whole MIDI thing. I'm getting off topic here with your question.
That's all right. Keep going. That's
just fine. To quickly tie it together. You know, so the guys were still hiring real musicians to realize their songs that were played by real people all in the same room at the same time. So that was a tremendous learning opportunity for me to bring different drums, different tunings and things and work with different engineers to learn a little bit about the recording process. Nowadays, I think most young players probably have their own setup that they can do that with, but you're just getting that one perspective. Whereas back in the day, I would work at a number of different studios all over the city in LA and some down in Orange County too, and work with different engineers, different boards, different microphones. And you can kind of see what would work, what wouldn't work. And even, you know, the feedback on the parts, getting a chance to play with the click. I used to do the Kids of the Kingdom show at Disneyland. So we do four shows a day. And at the time it was still on an 8-track reel, but it all had click and it was a tremendous, you know, like a 45-minute show with charts and reading. So that was a tremendous primer for getting into like the studio work kind of mindset, because you had to do it the same way each time and be, you know, fairly precise.
Yeah.
Staying with the click and playing the fills and the endings and things. Mm-hmm. So, long-winded answer, sorry.
Oh, no, that's all right. I mean, it gets us going because, you know, one thing that we don't talk a lot about on this podcast is some types of music that actually that you bring up. Like it could be at Disney and you know what? People underestimate how many live musicians that requires or like Cirque du Soleil. I mean, there's a lot of live musicians, you know, with Jerry Lopez over there and doing his
things,
you know, what goes on over there. And then the cruise ships, a lot of live musicians. I mean, we don't dig into this stuff too much, but our world of musicians and the guys that are out there getting their chops on these type of things, it's amazing, right?
It really is. And you bring up some very valid points about the live shows, you know, in Vegas. And I was fortunate. Back in the early 80s, we used to do these cruise ships for about a week, but I was working with the headliner, who would have been at the time Leslie Uggams.
Yeah, I remember Leslie,
famous multi-talent, great lady to work with.
Wonderful. Yeah.
And so those were on the cruise ship, so it was almost like a paid vacation because you'd only have one or two performances over the course of a seven-day cruise.
Right. Yeah.
But on the ship, there would be a number of different bands playing all the time.
Sure.
So our group would go and check them out. And a lot of it was kind of swingy, you know, kind of two beat jazz, kind of like Mad Men style, you know, soundtrack.
Yep. Yeah.
And it was fun because it was trying to appeal to people that are probably a little bit older generation wise, but still it was some very good quality players from all over the world. Some of the guys were from England.
Yeah.
Other guys were from some of the other countries where they were, you know, well-trained as jazz players and could sing and play horns. And then also they would have a live show, like a, you know, Broadway-type production in the showroom with a pit orchestra. And some of that stuff has started to become pre-records of maybe string parts and things like that. So there again, you're playing with a click. So there are a lot of job opportunities that just have to kind of be aware of them and, you know, make yourself available to play them.
Sure.
I just took my son on a cruise over over New Year's,
and
I saw the schedule for the shows, and I thought, you know, some of them didn't appeal to me. But they had one night, they had a show where it was like a rock review kind of a show, and I thought, okay, I'll go check it out. And I'm always skeptical about what I'm going to hear, and like, you know, who these guys are, and you know, what kind of quality musicians they get. But these guys knocked it out. They were doing within a 45-minute show, they did probably over 20-something songs, maybe not the full song, but like just almost – it was almost like a full show medley type of thing. And they had a full horn section. And they weren't a they were underground, and they had a riser that brought them up onto the stage from the ground.
Jeez.
And they were playing Chicago's 25 or 6 to 4, and they just destroyed it. It was unbelievable how good it was. So, yeah, there's really some really good players out there, you know, just in places where you might least expect it, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, that's good to hear. I'm happy to hear that because – you know, the trend is to try to cut things down and just have everything be pre-records.
Yeah.
You know, there are some acts that have to do tracks, which I understand, you know, sort of like live karaoke type singers that'll do their entire production with just, you know, being recorded. And for opera or certain styles, maybe that's more appropriate just to have the performer, you know, on stage with his massive production.
Yeah. Right.
Or their,
You know, Rick had mentioned a couple minutes ago of all the names. I mean, you've played – your career has been so wonderful and lengthy. But, you know, when you bring out the guys like Benson and, you know, Tim Weisberg and Benoit and Van Halen, I mean, all these guys, there's a couple guys going back to the classic artists that are really still out there. And, I mean, Burt Bacharach, how did you cross paths with him? And because you're still doing some work, right?
Yes. We just had a concert – over this past weekend out here in California at Rancho Mirage at the Agua Caliente Casino. Uh-huh. That's our second time to play there. It was a really great show, all sold out and wonderful audience. And he actually played a couple of his newer songs, which he's written recently, that I don't think one of them was recorded. It was a song about this with Rudy Perez about the shootings in the schools. And the name is escaping me. I got to look it up here. Maybe I'm talking to you. And then the other song, I don't think he's recorded yet. It was written with a young writer, this girl that lives in Nashville, and she was on in concert with us last summer when we played in England at the Royal Festival Hall. We did two nights there. Mm-hmm. But back to the way I met Bert was through another mutual friend, bass player named David Coy, C-O-Y. Mm-hmm. And David and I met back in the late 70s. We were doing what would be called out here in L.A., they call them casuals. I think they call them something else on the East Coast, meaning it's a job where you get called by a contractor to show up and play in a band, a dear friend of ours named Alan Remington, who's still around. So he would call us, and I met David, and we'd do different sessions together. And he was also involved with the Christian music scene back then, as he is today. So about 8 years ago, I think, he called and asked if I'd be interested in, you know, coming out to play with Bert, because they were looking to make some changes with the lineup. And I said, sure. So it started out just being one tour to Australia, which was, this was in like October, he called me, and then this tour was going to be the next April. It was called the Final Farewell Symphony Tour, which we did play with symphonies down there. So I said, yeah. And then, so I was just thinking it was sort of a one-off type opportunity. So we land in Australia. We're in the hotel in Adelaide checking in, and the manager comes down and says, hey, you guys, we just got a call to go to Tokyo for the jazz festival in September. I was like, oh, okay, cool. Let's do that. So basically, ever since then, he's been working an average of probably about 30 to 40 concerts a year.
Wow.
He did have a little setback in 2016 where he fell and injured. This is Bert, fell and broke his arm.
Yeah.
So we were off for about 9 months. But then he came back strong in 2017. We had back on the saddle in June. We played at UCLA at Royce Hall, and they did a bunch of more dates that year. And then last year, we were on tour again in Europe for about 3 weeks. We went all over. And he's very popular in England, but we got to go to Finland for the jazz festival there.
Yeah.
And let's see, where else? Denmark, Italy, and Germany, we hadn't been to, and Germany was great. They were really excited. In Berlin, we did a show. So they're already putting together a tour for this coming summer. In fact, I just got a text on the way over here asking about some more availability, like late June into July.
Wow.
So, yeah, he'll be 91, I think, but they keep going. So
yeah, isn't that amazing how these guys can just keep on going? And Bert specifically, I mean, he's got the real heart of a true collaborator. I mean, he's collaborated with so many people. One of my best, my favorites of his is when he did, Painted for My Memories with Elvis Costello.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Gorgeous project and the filming of that. And I'm like, you know, this guy just, his music will never die. You know, this, he just keeps on going at it. What a neat opportunity for you.
No, it's been amazing. You know, almost every week, if I'm somewhere at a supermarket or at the gym, I'll hear the, what's the version of Always There to Remind You, but it's the other the one that's like the pop group from England, I think.
Oh, the new one.
I almost always hear that song somewhere. And it's ironic, you know, either on a commercial or it's just like a background. And like I said, growing up, you know, that's very fond because my parents, you know, were always listening to his music and like that.
Sure.
So it's fun, to see how it's, you know, good material survives all the decades, I think, when people rediscover it. And it's fun to see the reaction of the audience that they get to hear the composer play his music live because it's really a special treat and there's still people that want to come see us. So
Exactly.
We're happy to be working. Yeah.
Sure, exactly.
Hey, I want to talk about a couple of gigs or tours in particular that stand out in your career. And one, of course, you played 18 years with Larry Carlton alone. And, you know, you also played on the classic 1979 live album, Mr. 335. That you know, that must have been a cool gig, and you're pretty young then, weren't you?
Yes, I think probably 23. We could do the math on that, but I think that's about right. Yeah, that was that all came about through another guitarist friend named Carlos Rios, and Carlos went on to play with Lionel Richie. I think he co-wrote some of those songs, like "Dancing on the Ceiling" and things like that.
Yeah.
So Carlos and I had met, and Carlos is from the South Bay, which is Torrance. And so Larry is from that area, and Larry's cousin, Steve Carlton, and who's younger, and Carlos Rios are friends. So they always used to call him Lawrence from Torrance. I think that was one of his monikers from the early days with Larry. But we were just I was going to school at Long Beach State, Cal State Long Beach, where I met a lot of great musicians. And we were up in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And I had taken the bus up there. It was a jazz festival weekend. And so it's Sunday morning and it was time to come home. And I'm like, I don't want to have to jump on that bus. It's going to be 8 hours.
Yeah.
So a couple of guys decided, let's just get a flight. We'll just go to Oakland Airport and go. I forget what the airline would have been back then. You know, we just went ahead and took a flight back to Orange County. I was still living at home at the time. Got home and, you know, we'd been having a lot of fun hanging out with the other bands and musicians. So hadn't had much sleep. Came home, was taking a nap. And the phone rings with Carlos calling, hey, can you come up and play this job we have at Hollahan's? And it's in Redondo Beach Pier. Like, what time does it start? It's like 4 o'clock. I go, okay, yeah, sure. Cause you're hungry to play. So that's how I met Larry. I go to this jam session. It was with Richard Elliott, was on saxophone.
Wow.
And a couple of other local guys who had, you know, knew about them. And we're playing cover tunes, you know, Grover Washington type stuff, kind of that early funky fusion stuff. And so in walks Larry, and I'm like, holy shit, Larry Carlton's here. And I didn't know that he was looking for a drummer at the time.
Wow.
So I'll wrap this up. And so fast forward, we ended up, after the session got done at like 8 o'clock, Larry goes, hey, you guys want to come up to my house and jam? I'm like, well, of course, you know, running on about 3 or 4 hours of sleep.
I'm like, oh my God,
I can't believe it. So we drive all the way up to his house at the time, which was right in the Hollywood Hills, had a full blown studio down in the basement with all the drums, everything. And we probably stayed till about 1 in the morning.
Wow.
And it was just unbelievable. You know, it's like being on a joyride or, you know, something that you couldn't even imagine. I was almost pinching myself. Is this a dream? Because I'd always, you know, listened to his music, and that record had just come out with the solo project with Greg Matheson, Abe Laboriel, and of course, Jeff Porcaro on drums.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of knew some of the songs and had either heard them, maybe Carlos had played them for me. So then a few weeks later, he calls me back to come jam with Greg and with Abraham. And then he calls me again, come back to jam with Greg and the late, great Pops, Robert Pops Popwell on bass.
Yep.
And so it was kind of like, you know, they both gave me the thumbs up and he ended up hiring me. And at the time, Neil Steubenhaus, who was a great bassist from the East Coast, had just moved to L.A. So that became the road band. It was Greg on keyboards, Larry, obviously, on the guitar, and then Neil on bass, and myself on drums. So we went off on tour to Japan, and I dropped out of my second semester senior year of college at Long Beach State. So parents won't like to hear this, but I'll say my rationale was school will always be there, but this is an opportunity, so I got to take it.
Well, you were in that. That was school.
That was school.
So I've been fortunate to not have to go back to school, although you know, still on my mind, like just to complete the degree for my parents, because you know I think they were, you know, hoping that I would at least do that. And I was never a music major. I was always business administration. So that kind of, you know, thing, you got to have some, you know, when are you going to get a real job, or you have to have something to fall back on? Exactly. And it's been interesting to study that too, because I enjoy that as sort of a hobby, but also from a fiscal responsibility standpoint to understand stocks and things. So it's just sort of a hobby of mine.
You know, it's just funny how that recording, that you know, that live recording in Japan, how it also took the form of another classic, you know, reference video that people always go back to. And I'm like, some of those things, like we talked a little earlier about the, you know, the other Boz 2004 recording, they're going to just live forever because they're such great projects, you know?
Oh, wow. That's very kind. You know, it's hard to tell or hard to know that, you know, some of the things you do, how long it'll last or how long it won't. It's kind of on that note, you know, I've had a bunch of sort of behind the scenes projects that people don't know about where it's like been really fun and a labor of love kind of thing. But chances are nobody will get to hear them. It doesn't mean that it's not good quality or that you shouldn't do it. So it's, I've been doing a couple of projects lately with guys that are sort of hobbyists, but they have a true passion for music and they played it their whole life. But they're now at a point later on with their careers, with either being recently retired, that they're able to realize the dream of playing music and, you know, hiring guys like us to come and play with them. So, yeah, it's an interesting, you know, thing to be able to get to do it full time or as a pro. And people are always amazed when they when I tell them that's my job. It's like, yeah. So,
yep, so, that's what I do.
That's what we do. Yeah, I know. It's our passion. So we're very fortunate it was, you know, to be able to still be in the game.
Yeah. Wasn't Paulinho da Costa on that live album as well, on that tour with you?
He wasn't on the tour, so this brings up an interesting point. Maybe there was some overdubs, I don't recall. He is on the studio recording. I'm pretty sure he played on it.
Okay.
Then we did do a few concerts from time to time where we would have a live, a percussionist. So we used to do with Larry every year in the summertime, July, they have the Winter Park, Colorado has a nice jazz festival.
Okay.
So you're up at about 10 or 12,000 feet way up the mountain, but it's beautiful, it's sunny, it's gorgeous. And, you know, we're flying in from LA, so it's a little bit of an altitude thing. And people are there to hear Larry. We did it at least two or three times. So the one time the band was, it must have been Greg Matheson. I'm not sure who would have been on bass. Oh, John Pena on bass.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
And the great Alex Acuna on percussion, who just recently got honored at one of the Naris events or something. There was I just saw it on Facebook. He's a wonderful musician, a great friend, and also a fellow Christian guy, believer. So we're up there playing, and we're having a ball. You know, people are digging it. They're on the ski slope, and so the stage is facing the mountain, and everybody's got their coolers and not placemats, what do you say, not towels or beach blankets. Yeah. And so we do our set. It's great. The next group up is the Wynton Marsalis Jazz Group.
Wow.
So I'm going to have to be cool about this. I guess I'll tell the story. So anyways, we get done with our set. People are going nuts. Yay, great. So we get off the stage. Those guys come out, and it's a great band. I don't recall exactly who's in the group, but he's leading it on trumpet. And it's a quintet, and they've all got their, you know, formal suits, white collar shirts, and, you know, straight ties and the sunglasses. So they're playing some really cool tunes. And suddenly they decide to kind of play this funky beat, which sounds good. And then Wynton goes up to the mic, and he goes, "The music you just heard before this, that's not jazz." So he's kind of like discounting what it was that the crowd had just heard. Yeah. And boy, oh boy, I know Alex Acuna flipped out. He's like, "What? What is he doing? Why is he doing that? Just play your music and it's great." So it was kind of a point of contention. I mean, he was making a big deal about, well, those guys, he didn't name anybody or anything. In other words, like, we're purists. This is really jazz. When that stuff you just heard wasn't. And about half the crowd just picked up their beach blankets and their coolers and marched out of the venue. So he kind of shot himself in the foot. And like I said, this is many years ago, probably in the 80s. I don't remember the exact date, but it was just, it really didn't need to happen. I mean, it's, you know, apples and oranges. People are there to enjoy all kinds of music, and that's part of the variety of the festival. It's really fun.
Wow, that's interesting.
But I just, as far as the percussion, I remember Alex was very upset about it because he's played with Weather Report. He's played with some amazing heavyweight jazz artists that are super relevant. And then for him to hear, you know, people discounting the performance that we had just done. And it was actually a really fun day, too, because we played, you know, Larry was in a good mood.
Yeah.
Let the band kind of stretch out and featured each guy. And it was, you know, we were feeling good about it. The crowd was digging it. And then to have it sort of.
That's funny. Wow.
It's like the school principal came in and said, "Hey, you guys all get D's on your test." Or but I don't know. So I'll let you guys decide if that's really broadcast. It might be. I don't want to offend anyone or not a judgment about anybody, but it just. Sidebar story.
No doubt. That's cool. Okay. That's neat. Hey, listen, there's you're doing another gig. And another guy, I cannot let go of this because these are very significant artists. We've talked about some of these legends, but Barry Manilow is still going at it.
Oh, yeah.
And he sure is. You're doing work with him. And how much contact in working with him do you ever get with Barry and, with the music? Working with the MDs, how much influence does he have in connection with you have? I mean, working together with him.
Well, I did do the tour. It was like 1980 through 82 was like my sort of steady residency there.
Yep.
And then fast forward to, it would have been our son was born. So this is late, like 1998 or 99 maybe. And I got a chance to work with Barry in a live performance in Victoria, Canada. It was for the David Foster Foundation.
Yeah. Okay.
And so Barry was going to be the special guest artist. And it's a foundation where they raise money for families that have people in their family that are getting major transplants done across Canada. So it's a really cool foundation. And so David, you know, was on the bill. And in fact, Josh Groban was just a teenager, I think, and he was one of the new artists and that sang at that event, I remember. So that was the last time I played live with him. But then we did work on a recording project several years later that Michael Lloyd was producing at the studio here in L.A. And then I did go see one of the shows. Ironically, when we were on tour with Bert, was it 2 years ago? We had the night off, so I got to go see Barry's show at the O2, I think that's what it's called, in London. It's like a big sports arena type place. And I have several friends that are still in the group with him, with another good friend named Melanie Taylor, who's a wonderful vocalist, and her, I'm not sure if their husband or boyfriend is Terry Woolman. He's another musician here in LA. And then Michael Lent is on guitar, and actually the bass player is Andrew Ford, who I play with the Nick Marischal project. So currently, and then they called me early last year, as you recall, I think David Garibaldi had an injury with Tower of Power. He got hit by the train.
Right.
So the longtime drummer that was with Barry was named Russ McKinnon.
Yeah.
In fact, they offered me the gig back in, I guess it was 98. Or maybe 2000, and our son was just born, and I was like, we're just going to do weekends, but then, of course, management gets involved, and so they want to try to book more dates and tours.
Yeah.
And my wife wasn't 100% comfortable with me being on on tour while she's trying to raise two kids.
Right,
so
right.
I decided to say, you know, reluctantly said, well, I'm going to have to say no. So there's a history there. Then they did call Russ, and Russ was on the gig up until last year. David Garibaldi got hit by that train up in Oakland. Him and the bass player were injured pretty severely. Thank God they both survived and they're back playing with the band.
Yeah.
So then there's Towers got dates on the book. So they're trying to balance the drum chair between, I believe his name, Herman Matthews. So then Russ McKinnon is getting called in also to sub because he had played with Tower for a period. This is all going back to the Barry thing. So then I did get a call from Barry's MD asking if I would be available to come out and sub on a few dates that were on the East Coast. They were doing those, what they call like TV promo dates, because he had a new record that was out.
Yep.
So I was kind of waiting to hear if I was going to have to go and was going to try to clear out the schedule to make myself available. Ended up they were able to sort of work it out and Russ was able to do it. But now I know that they've made a change on some of the players. I don't think Russ is doing the band anymore, but Barry's got a whole bunch of new work. So he's still out there doing it. I know he's had some health concerns, but he was always fun. I learned a lot on that gig back in 80-82 about production, how to do a live show, the pacing, lighting. It was just interesting. We'd spend hours in rehearsal. So it was somewhat painstaking, but it was really valuable experience. And musically, the takeaway for that, and I'll tie this together with the Promise Keepers tour. We were playing these stadium events, and a lot of the songs are really, really slow tempo, like the metronome marking being like 64.
Wow.
Okay. So it's like a ballad tempo, like 1, 2, 3, 4, or slower even.
Yeah.
And so his thing with Barry, he didn't want to hear any eighth notes on the hi-hat. It was always just playing that pulse, chick, 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 you know, very slow, deliberate. And boy, it's so powerful, but it's really challenging because I've been coming off Larry Carlton and we're playing this more jazzy fusion. Instrumental subdivisions.
Yeah.
And now I'm just kind of got the handcuffs on to just play quarters, but it really helped me get my time together and understand how to play that, and especially in a live setting.
Sure.
And also to play it at different volume levels.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward to 1996, and I got called to work with this men's ministry called Promise Keepers, and they're doing stadiums. The first event was in Minneapolis at the Dome where the Twins play. And we're playing, you know, a lot of ballads for some of the worship tunes and stuff. So, man, it was like, wow, okay, God had a plan. He wanted me to learn how to play those ballads so I could jump in there and nail it pretty much, you know, just understand how to play those quarter note pulse kind of thing. It's very dramatic with big tom-tom fills. And it's really exciting because it just there's so much space in between each note. And it features what the lyric's doing and, you know, the contour of the melody.
Yeah.
So anyways, I just would admit, sort of got off track
here. That's fine. That's fine. That's fine.
I'm good at that. But these guys gave me the license to tell some stories.
So that's true.
Exercising the privilege.
You have free reign. Now let's see what you can remember now, because we want to go back to how you got started in this business. And you're a Connecticut kid, right?
That's right. Yeah. Wow. You guys have done your homework. Yes.
Just like
the from
just
Waterbury.
Like, yeah. Oh, okay. Just like the Picaros. Yeah. They're from Connecticut also. Yeah.
They are. Yes.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. When I, one of the jokes, I forget which son was always saying, hey, you're an ex-con, you know, like C-O-N, the abbreviation for the, for Connecticut. So there's some other great musicians from there as well. Trying to think. Oh, and I know there was a big drum teacher that's famous, Al Lepic. Is that his name, I believe?
Okay.
But a lot of guys bring up his name. I don't know if he's still around. And then another drum builder who's a dear friend, Joe Montaneri. And he's worked with a lot of different high-end drummers here on the West Coast and, you know, all over the world. There is a contingency of some guys, you know, from Connecticut.
Yeah.
I just recently reconnected with a son of the guy who gave me my first pair of drumsticks when I was at a wedding reception, Mark DePaula.
Okay.
And his dad's name, they used to call him Dippy DePaula. And he had a trio. And so I was probably, maybe 7, 8, 9 years old. And, you know, had my little suit on. We're at some wedding. I don't know whose it was. And I just was parked on the front of the stage. They had like a, you know, reception hall, just staring at the drums the entire time. I mean, I can vividly remember it. So last year I got to meet Mark, who's one of the sons, because I called the Connecticut Union to find out about Dippy DePaula. This is 2 years ago now. And he got back to me on Facebook and sent me pictures of his dad's trio. I forgot the name of the group. And then last year I was subbing in on Albert Lee's gig on the East Coast. We did about 12 or 13 concerts in the course of like 15 days, all one-nighters, you know, driving around the Ford Econoline van on tour. And we were in Fairfield, Connecticut. So Mark came down to the gig and also my cousin who lives in Connecticut, Joe Cristiano. And we were hanging out backstage. It was just really a neat connection. And I gave him a pair of sticks. Just as a sort of a, you know, token, because his dad had given me my first pair of sticks. So I was here. And he's a drummer of sorts, too. He still plays a little bit. But, you know, we stay in touch with each other, and it's just sort of a full circle. But that's the Connecticut connection. We moved to California in 64 to the area kind of where I live now. And I'm, you know, very grateful for the chance to be on the West Coast. I think if I had stayed back there, I probably would have gravitated towards Manhattan or, you know, a lot of the guys that do the Broadway shows in the city. And there's some great musicians based out of New York.
Yeah.
But it's always fun to visit there. I think logistically, the living lifestyle, you know, is nice. I remember visiting Peter Erskine. He was living there and they were just getting ready to move back to California. This would have been, I forget when he moved back, but so we were friends, you know, for a long time. And then through another dear friend who's a great musician, Chad Wackerman. We gotta mention his name.
Oh, yeah.
The Crank Tones, our little fun band that we've had for over 30 years, that we do all our little Christmas tour. So, yeah, Peter was in the city, I think, for a while, and then maybe they started having their family and then, you know, decided to move back to California. And obviously he's, you know, one of the world's finest drummers and educators, and he's very busy at USC and playing all kinds of records.
We need to get Chad on the show. Yeah. I mean, we referenced him when we just talked to David Garfield about Los Lobotomies.
That's right.
And he's on that project.
Yeah.
And
yes, he is.
I want to definitely talk to him. I bet you he'd have some amazing insights on on the industry. But that's I'm glad you mentioned his name. You know.
Yes. He's a dear friend, and you know, tremendous amount of respect for his ability and humbleness and, you know, just he's played on some amazing projects. Alan Holdsworth, all the Zappa stuff, a number of different people. He's going to be getting ready to go on tour at the end of this month or in February with James Taylor because he's really good friends with Jimmy Johnson. They've done a lot of work together.
Yeah.
And so Chad, I think, is subbing in maybe for Steve Gadd. That's pretty heavyweight.
Yeah, that is heavy.
Yeah, Chad.
Anybody that plays sure in that, in James Taylor's band is heavy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Next week is our, you know, annual NAMM show out here in Anaheim. So it's a 4-day music convention. And I know that the drum workshop booth is going to have part of David Garfield's band jamming there. So I think it's on Thursday. He invited me to come by and sit in. Lenny Castro and also Chad will be playing. And I think they're going to have two drum sets. So maybe we'll jump up there and I'll try to keep up.
Yeah. Rick was out there last year, and I think two of our correspondents will be out there. Actually, one, two, three.
Scott Gross, Loretta,
and Don Brighton.
And Mikhail's going.
Mikhail also.
Yeah, oh, good. I'll keep an eye out for them if I happen to see them. Or we'll pass them.
You know, you passed a couple tracks just in preparation for me and Rick. You passed a couple tracks to us. One of them is very neat. It's one that you did some support on. It's called So Sad, and that's by Jennifer Warrens, she's such a lovely voice. And you recorded that at Capitol Records, Studio B. Tell us about this track. You sent that to us, and I thought it was very lovely. It's a nice track.
I just recently got a copy of the album. I got called. I'm trying to think how I got the call for that. This was something that we were doing, and it was tied in with, you're going to laugh, but Acura had some new sound system for their car. So we were doing this thing, and I believe it was Lee was on bass, probably Dean Parks on guitar, and I think Greg Leese, who's a wonderful pedal steel player and guitarist, and my other dear friend who's been on, I call him the United Way, because thanks to him, I'm working. That was an old slogan they used to have. Jim Cox, COX, is just probably my favorite musician on the planet. He can play anything. So it was Jim on the session and then Jennifer. So what we would do, and I think, I got to remember who the engineer was, Elliot Shiner, does that sound right?
Yeah, probably. That makes sense because he's the one that designed the Acura sound system.
Yeah,
it's
that's
his,
right.
His
okay, then that's correct.
Yep.
So we would record a song and then they would take the track and he'd do a quick mix and they take it out to the car and play it. And then when they'd say, hey, what do you guys think? We'd sit in the car and listen to these tracks. So it was kind of like we weren't sure what the real intent was, but basically it was a way for her to get an album recorded and also, a pretty high level of attention to the sonics of it with that group and also with the studio and Elliot and everything. So just, I think it was just middle of last year, I finally got a copy of the CD and Vinnie Caliuta is on the record too. So I was trying to make sure I didn't falsely credit or look at something that didn't have me, but I kind of remembered that song and this ties in on the drummer perspective of like playing brushes. So I was very fortunate to, I'm no expert by any stretch, but using the brushes as an implement is so valuable for me. I did all those Rod Stewart standard albums with Richard Perry here on the West Coast. And it was just because of the, ability to kind of play jazz with a click, play the tuxedo two beat Saturday night.
Exactly.
Just keep it kind of swinging and real smooth. And so whenever, I always try to, tracks that feature that texture, I'm always intrigued with if I hear it on the radio or somebody that's playing, it's like, wow, even like Mitch Mitchell on Up From the Sky is a Jimi Hendrix thing where he's playing the brushes on that track. And it's always, and then Steve Smith has a version of that on one of the Journey songs where he's playing brushes. So, it gets used primarily in jazz, but it can be used in a lot of pop, Americana, country, world beat music and stuff. It's just a great texture. So it's a lot of fun. And I would say, a fair number of my gigs lately have just been where I'm just playing brushes.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it. I'm trying to get better at it all the time. There's some really great players out there, Clayton Cameron, and Jeff Hamilton, some of the legendary guys who really understand it and play it beautifully with the brushes. So that's that track in particular, it was just kind of a poignant thing that like I said, I think I picked it mainly because it was featuring brushes just as a textural change.
You know, it's funny you mention that album because I've had several Acuras and I have a one right now, and mm-hmm. and they always give us these CDs that are, you know, 5.1.
Yes, you that's know, right. That's
and
right.
I recall this track. I think it's on okay. one of these CDs that they give you,
oh,
you know,
funny.
When you yeah. buy these okay. cars. And, yeah. and it's beautiful because, you know, they're 5.1 and the sound system on those cars, it's just amazing.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's a beautiful car. We had, you know, the Honda Odyssey vans when the kids were younger, mm-hmm. Had two or three of them, and they're just, you know, really well made.
Yeah.
And then the Acura is really nice. It's the top level vehicle probably
yeah.
in the world. I mean, it's an amazing. Yeah. And that sound system was great. I remember we were in like a smaller, it was like a sedan.
Yeah.
So we'd have to get in the back seat, but it did sound good. I was like, wow, I'm going to get in an accident because I'll be distracted listening rather exactly. than driving.
Well, I yeah. want to talk about one track that's not jazz, not folk, not anything, but it okay. is you. And in fact, I think it also involves our engineer on your side of the recording right now, Gordon. And you guys yeah. play in this band. It's called the Brick Alley Blues Band. And it's
yes.
you sent us this beautiful track. It's called Red Wine and Oatmeal. And it features you on vocals, which sort of falls in line with a lot of drummers that do sing, like Phil Collins and Don Henley. But
oh, wow.
this is a different.
Oh, boy.
This
I don't know if I could be mentioned in the same sentence as that. But, yeah.
but it's a fun. It was a great. Yeah. Talk to us about this track. It's a fun project.
Sure. Yeah, this was something. I'm sitting here next to Gordon, so he'll hear it. we were all sitting around at a coffee shop, or I think he just decided to meet with the other guys in the band, Rick White, Bob Moore, and Greg Vale, and Gordon and myself. And we were just having coffee up in Long Beach somewhere. And, you know, sort of at the time, things were slow work-wise. We're like, hey, you know, let's do an album. So Rick's got a nice setup at his house. And we all went over there. I think it was recorded literally in about 2 days.
Wow.
So the first day we did songs, and each guy, Rick White's a great singer, and Bob Moore is a great singer as well. And guitar, they're both guitar players. Okay. So there's no keyboard, but there's Rick White does the synth guitar, so he can kind of make a sound that sounds sure. a lot like a Hammond B3.
Yeah.
And he's a really soulful guy. He's from Oklahoma, and he played with a bunch of different artists over the years. And Bob Moore works at, I think, Knott's Berry Farm or Disneyland,
mm-hmm.
both. Yeah, he's at both, and he's a great singer and guitarist. So they all had original material that no one, you know, had heard or hadn't had a chance to record. So it was just kind of a collaborative effort. And Gordon wrote a couple of songs with Greg Vale that were instrumental tunes. So I was the only guy that didn't have a song. So I went home that night, and I had sort of been playing around with an idea. And I sat down and tried to pull up manuscript paper, which to start writing music. I go, all right, I got this blues idea. Let me do this red wine and oatmeal. And then it was just kind of a goofy twist on sort of a familiar sounding line, you know, like a jazz blues line.
Yeah, right.
And we just did it. And I think it's, you know, there's no seriousness about it, but it's kind of a little earworm.
Yeah.
Because I do play it live on occasion. I was doing a couple other gigs where people are getting tired and say, hey, can you sing? And I said, well, I've got one song that I know how to do. it's a blues in F, so I'll count it off. And they're like, oh, that's easy enough. So I've played it live a handful of times, and people always seem to get a kick out of it.
You guys definitely had a lot of fun with that, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for – yeah. But Phil Collins and Don Henley, you got nothing to worry about.
Yeah, you know, this track, Red Wine and Oatmeal, is a fun little track, and you know, you're like Addie mentioned, you know, you're a pretty good singer. And this track, of course, features you. And we're going to stop for a second and we're going to play it. Red Wine and Oatmeal from the Brick Alley Blues Band, featuring our guest today, John Ferraro, on Inside Music Cast.
Red wine and oatmeal. Can't do a thing about the way that I feel. Red wine and oatmeal. Can't do a thing about the way that I feel. Eat my oatmeal in the morning, drink my red wine at night. Red wine and oatmeal. Red wine and oatmeal. Can't do a thing about the way that I feel. Red wine and oatmeal. Can't do a thing about the way that I feel. Eat oatmeal in the morning, drinking red wine at night. Red wine and oatmeal. oatmeal.
Worked on a really cool project with Sterling Ball.
Yes.
And of course, the amazing Jim Cox. And the project is called
Yes.
The Mutual Admiration Society. And you know what? You were talking about NAMM a moment ago. And when I was out there
Yes.
last year, I went by the Ernie Ball booth.
Ernie Ball.
And,
oh, yeah.
Because I wanted to go hear Steve Lukather speak. And there were some other amazing guitarists there as well. And Sterling talked about this Mutual Admiration Society when he was there, and I had, you know, I've been wanting to check it out, but it involved a lot of people taking part, and it essentially, you know, several guitar players, you know, spinning their takes on 13 different tracks, and of course you're involved, and walk us through this project and how it came to be, how you got involved.
Yeah. Well, just history with Sterling. We went to junior high school together here in Newport Beach. He lived on, it's called Lido Island. It's a really nice community.
Yeah.
And another great musician that came from there that I should mention is Jack Marshall, who was a composer, the theme song for the Munsters and a number of different soundtracks. Yeah. I think he worked with Peggy Lee. Wow. And all his kids are in the industry. Frank Marshall is the son who's married to Kathleen Kennedy,
who
does all the Spielberg movies.
Yeah.
And then Phil Marshall is a composer, guitarist. And then Matt Marshall is a bass player. And I think there's a daughter, but I don't think she does anything with music. But so, in other words, this one little island had some pretty heavyweight talent on there.
Sure.
The Ernie Ball family and the Marshall family. So throughout high school, I was always in the marching band and kind of a nerd because we had to have our short hair. And Sterling was this renegade rock guy, and he'd already been working for the company. And, you know, he sort of knew his path was going to be to run the company one day, which is what he's doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he started a club called the Future Rock and Roll Stars of America. So all these guys had long hair and they're wearing like rock star clothes. And Sterling had his own car. So they'd go up to the Whiskey a Go-Go to see bands. But he'd be bringing these guys in the groups, you know, Strings and the Roxy, all these clubs. So he was way ahead of his game, you know, kind of with like
right.
knowing people in the industry and, you know, meeting them in person at the trade shows, Jimmy Page, all kinds of people. So I was sort of afraid of the guy because I was like, wow, this radical guy with the long hair and he's a little bit wild, you know. So then we get out of high school and I'm going to junior college at Orange Coast College here in California, Costa Mesa. And we end up jamming or somehow, oh, I know, there's another guy on our street two doors down that used to have jam sessions in the garage. Another dear friend of ours that passed away, Greg Edlefour, who was a great drummer and really great. He turned me on to a lot of cool, like John Guerin and Bad Company, you know, certain rock things. And so he knew that I was like more studying the mainstream. But Greg was a really dear friend. He ended up willing his Camco set to me, which is still amazing. I was very honored. So Sterling and I, you know, started playing music together a little bit. And then we came up with the idea of starting this fun band just for Sunday afternoon jamming called Biff Babies All-Stars, because that was one of Sterling's nicknames.
Okay.
And so he invited Albert Lee to come down.
Yeah.
And I said, well, we ought to call Jim Cox because he's the perfect guy, you know. So we've had a long relationship. I think Sterling would be more accurate. I think this is like early 1980. And so we started playing a handful of gigs. Then other guitar players started finding out, or through Albert, they all admired Albert, especially like Steve Morris and Steve Lukather.
Yeah.
And then I think it was 92, we had an opportunity to play at the NAMM show. And at the time, Eddie Van Halen was signed up with the company. So we did this big concert at one of the hotels. And, you know, it was all three of those guitar players I mentioned. I don't think Lukather played that night, but it was Steve Morris, Albert, and Eddie were the featured guys. And then the late, great Sherwood Ball, who was an incredible singer. He's on all the Toyota commercials you hear out here in California. He was in the group, too, to sing, you know, to kind of carry the vocal load. But so I've had a long, long history with Sterling, and he's always been very kind to me. And I'm sitting literally in the spot where we've recorded all the basic tracks for that project, the Mutual Admiration. All the basics were cut here at the Broken Prop Studio.
Right.
Gordon Russfold, proprietor, dear friend that I met at Orange Coast College.
Hey, Gordon.
Back in 1974, we cut the tracks, and then we would – Sterling is so connected, so he would get up the next morning and – call Lukather, call Steve Vai, call Steve Morris and say, hey, listen to this track. What do you think? And then they sort of selected the tracks that they wanted to play on. Wow. Each guy said, well, I want to play on that. So it was kind of a really like a, you know, just started off as being sort of a documentary jam session. And it we started sending the tracks around to the guys and they send them back to us. I think the most one that was probably the most mind-blowing is the one with John Petrucci from Dream Theater. It's a Disney medley that we pretty much came up with on the spot in the studio with Jim, the help of Jim Cox, who could piece things together.
Wow.
And that track was a lot of fun. I don't think we technically have clearance to to use it.
But I was going to ask you about that.
And, you know, all the Disney copyright stuff.
Yeah.
And then there is one original tune on there that is sort of in the light of we were talking about Jack Marshall or Frank Marshall, or sorry, Jack Marshall and Phil Marshall, and it's called Strip Mall Gourmet.
Yeah.
Because it's got kind of this little quasi early Hollywood boogaloo feel, I would call it. And it's sort of my tribute to John Guerin, who was one of my heroes back in the day because played with Tom Scott in the LA Express. And, you know, him and Larry had played a lot together with Joni Mitchell. So it's just a composite of a lot of different fun elements, nothing too pretentious. And then we have a couple of other guest bass players on there too, a dear friend named Dave Stone that I played with at Disneyland back in 76. You know, I still play with him almost once or twice a month at one of the church gigs. And another dear friend, Brad Heyman from Australia, that's a upright, kind of a slap bass player. He's on one of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Sterling did primarily bass on the rest of them. So
cool.
Sterling would always play bass when we did the Biff Babies gigs, but he's always been sort of a closet guitar guy because he always was such a huge fan of Albert. And when you're overdubbing with Sterling, you got to keep the tape rolling on guitar because he'll play, this is a remarkable thing that I've never heard before. And I've, you know, been in the studio with all these top-notch guitar guys. So they're kind of the top-notch guys or whatever you want to call them will craft a solo and really work out the things and say, no, I need to do that right there again because I want to do this line. Sterling, it's almost like John Coltrane experience where he will play a completely different solo each time you'd run the track to him. So we were ending up with 18, 19 tracks worth of stuff going, oh my gosh, how are we going to sort through all this?
Yeah.
And each time it's a little bit different. He just comes at it from a completely sort of a reckless, like, you know, devil may care attitude. But the stuff you end up coming up with is pretty remarkable. Yeah. So for him, you know, it's fun, it's a hobby. And I think was really, you know, happy the way it turned out. And then all the Guitar Hero guys that are on there are all big fans of Sterling, just as a person, as a human being.
Yeah, exactly.
Philanthropist. And he's got donated a lot of money to polycystic kidney research at UCLA, over like $2 million with this annual golf tournament. And then his other passion is called, the Smokers. He's got a industry for barbecue. King of the Smokers, okay. Or it's Big Papa Smokers.
Very cool.
Still will be the name of it. Yeah. So he's, you know, like the Renaissance man. He just had his 64th birthday over the weekend. I was supposed to learn how to play it on ukulele. I was going to send him a recording of it, but I haven't sat down. Learned how to play it. So when I'm 64, happy birthday, Sterling.
Yeah,
we love you.
Happy birthday, Sterling.
So yeah, it's been fun. We already started the second project. We've got 4 or 5 songs recorded. And 3 of them are featuring Chad Wackerman and myself. So it's double drums. So they're going through the tracks right now, just getting them lined up. And there's one thing, I probably shouldn't talk too much about it because I'm not sure if we're going to have the personnel. But there's probably the same guys that were on it last time. But now some of the other friends of theirs have found out and they want to be guest artists on it.
I do want to say that I saw something on your – it might have been on your your website, or it might have been the Mutual Admiration Society site or something, that you actually posted a few videos of some conversations with you and Sterling and a couple of the guitarists.
Yeah.
I really recommend to our listening audience that you go there and search that out and listen to how this – it'll go a little more in depth and hear it from Sterling and from John. And I forget who else was on those clips, but it's really informative as to how this whole project really materialized.
If you go to on Facebook, I think it's Mutual Admiration Society Music is how you find it.
Gotcha.
And we had a day where we were at East West Studios in Hollywood. It's the old United Western building there that's still up and running. I was just there last week.
Okay.
And he had, you know, a video crew come in. So we had the only guy that wasn't there, or two guys weren't there, Jay Graydon was unable to be there, and Steve Lukather was out either with Ringo or Toto, so he wasn't there.
Yeah.
But all the other guys that played on the record were there, and we just had sort of a round table, you know, sit-down discussion, and then he went one-on-one with each of the featured guitarists as well, and Jim Cox is interviewed there too. So, yeah, it's just a, you know, very informal day at the studio, just chatting about the project and listening to each track, and it's amazing how humble each one of those world-class guitar players are, and they're so amazing that they're fans of each other.
You know,
like,
exactly.
Man, I can't believe you played that great lick. And they were, you know, they would just couldn't stop praising each other, kind of. But, you know, it's a heartfelt thing because I think they respect what it takes to be able to play music at that high caliber and in the forefront like that. Some of their solos are just amazing. Yeah. And Sterling has some really good ones on there too, on mandolin, and he's playing, you know, electric guitar and some acoustic. So it's really, like I said, just a fun labor of love project. And we were able to get a deal. I think it's on Mascot is the label that it's on. So if anybody out there still buys CDs.
Yeah, exactly.
Or downloads or whatever they do, you can find it that way. Yeah.
So. Well, hey, John, if you don't mind, let's pause for a second. And we want to check out a track from this project called the Mutual Admiration Society that, of course, you've cooked up here with Sterling Ball and Jim Cox. And this particular track is one you've allowed us to play, and this is called Strip Mall Gourmet. And this particular track features Jay Graydon. This is from our guest today, John Ferraro, on Inside MusicCast. earlier in the show, you put an earworm it through my head, and I've got it going. It's always something there to remind me. And you mentioned that it was remade in the 80s, and that was by a band called Naked Eyes. I don't know if we could.
Okay.
I don't know if we were trying to remember who it was, but it just dawned on me.
So I was going to say Soft Cell, but that's a different guy.
That was Tainted Love.
He came and he came and sat in with us. He did. We did a show at the Palladium, I think it's called, in London. And it was him and the other singer. Oh, my gosh. I can see his face. Never going to give you up.
Rick Astley.
Rick Astley.
Really great. Rick Astley. Thank you. Yeah. So they were guest artists, and also Josh Stone.
Yeah.
It was like a fun concert. And so Mark, what's his name? But he sang Blue on Blue. And then one of the other songs you mentioned earlier, the Elvis Costello project, I Just Don't Know What to Do With Myself.
Yeah.
So each artist had two or three of the songs that were mentioned. But there was rumor that we were going to have that band that you just said. I already forgot their name.
Oh, Naked
come
Eyes.
And play, come and play that their version of the Burt tune. But I think it would have required a little too much production changeover with all their gear and everything. So they opted not to do that.
Well, you know, with the new year ahead of us, can you tell us what's cooking for you this year? Any tours or gigs? I mean, and how do you go by selecting the projects that you do take on, ones that are offered to you? What's going on with you for the rest of 2019?
Right. In the first quarter, it's always, interesting to see kind of how it ramps up.
Yeah.
I've got several live concerts at a place called the Canyon Club, and there's three locations.
Yeah.
One's in Agoura. One's in Santa Clarita, and I think there's one that's maybe called something The Rose or something else. It's in Pasadena, but it's with the same band that I mentioned, a guy earlier named Nick Marischal, and he's got some really fun music, a few original tunes and a few cover tunes, and it's a great band. So we're doing opening act slots. I know we're opening for Rita Coolidge.
Cool.
And I think Mark Farner is one of them.
Mark Farner, wow.
I forget who else. Mark Farner from Grand Funk Railroad, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Yeah. And there's one other group, I forget which one, but we've already done a series of opening acts with that group. So that's this is for the next 3 months. We've got some weekends, and you can find out the information on nickmarischal.com, the dates. In addition to that, there's one or two Burt dates every month. We're playing at Paula Casino in February, and then up in Seattle with the Symphony in March. Mm-hmm. And then, like I said, the summer, we've got dates booked in Europe with Burt. The other projects I'm working on, going to be up in Monterey with a fun band with a dear friend named Dave Murata. Mm-hmm. And actually, Dave, I forgot to mention him earlier. He was the best man at my wedding, but we played together at Disneyland back in 76. And he sort of spearheaded the movement for Sterling to do some recording. So there's a album prior to the Mutual Admiration album, and it features Jim is on it, of course, and I think Albert's on it, but it's a little bit almost more like a very casual setting where nobody else came to play, or didn't get as many guest artists on it. But Dave was very instrumental. Dave's a great bass player. His family's from Monterey, California, and I'm told that he's distant relatives of the Murata drumming family somehow,
as in Rick.
But Rick and Jerry. Yeah, Jerry is great. I love Jerry's playing too. Got to see him years ago. We were on tour, had a night off, and he was playing with Peter Gabriel. It was so cool. They all came out on stage wearing white, all white, and they came marching in with parade drums. I forget, maybe it was in Denmark or
that's cool.
May have been in Holland. It was a really cool show. And man, that was really haunting, just really captivating. The concert was great.
Cool.
Dave's from Monterey, California. His dad's a great accordion player, still alive. Mike Sr., we love the guy. And he can play some burning bebop kind of swinging accordion. Yeah. So his whole family is really great. I did want to mention Dave too, because we played out tons of sessions together. We were in the Carl Verheyen band. And actually, Dave worked for Burt many years ago as the bass player, but then he went on to play. He was on Gino Finelli and a number of different artists. He's a fellow studio musician. We played on all the Pioneer Laserdisc sessions.
Jeez, yeah.
And that was really fun. We got a chance to play everything from Cab Calloway to Led Zeppelin. So those would be like four-day campouts where we would do about 28 tracks.
Wow.
And it was literally, the variety was all across the board. So I remember getting a chance to bring in a really giant drum set to do the Zeppelin stuff. It was really fun. Wow. And then I had, you know, sort of a standard type studio kit, and we were doing all kinds of different music. They, you know, send us a list, and we just go in there for 4 days in a row and do like seven tracks a day.
Wow.
Everybody playing together live.
And sure.
Like sometimes we'd have a string section or a horn section. So we were still recording on tape back then. You'll get a kick out of this.
Yeah.
So the producer was starting to rack up such a huge budget on the tape. And then the engineer came up with the idea. He goes, let's stripe it. And I'm like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Rick, you'll probably understand this better. But we were using 24 track tape, but we were getting three passes on it. So we were only recording eight tracks at a time.
Right.
So you would be able to get, you know, three times the amount of information because the tape budget was just getting way out of line. So, and somewhere in some garage, there's all the charts and probably all the tapes from those sessions, but we would have them all transcribed. I remember having to learn, and I can't play it correctly, Higher Love.
Yeah.
One of the tracks.
Yeah.
Because that drum intro is really cool. Like it's JR playing it. And the guy who did the takedown, I mean, he nailed it, but I was like, holy crap, how do I play this thing? And it's got this little rim clickety clack thing.
Right.
It's kind of but the way it comes in with the fill and it hits on beat one, somehow he was able to reverse engineer it to find out what beat it started on. So,
holy cow.
You know, I'd be very hard pressed to sit down again and try to play it. I should probably go back and listen just for a challenge.
Yeah.
But it was all kinds of music. I mean, all kinds of pop artists. This is what Pioneer wanted for their Laserdisc library. So I think those sessions were happening probably in the 90s or maybe into early 2000s. But
wow.
That was a lot of fun. There's well over 500 songs that we recorded.
Jeez.
Over the course of that.
Wow.
And it was, you know, stuff that was popular at the time, Night Ranger or, you know, maybe Patsy Cline. So it was really fun because you could really, they'd play us the originals and then we'd try to come as close as we could sound-wise and feel-wise. But some of those records, you're going, man, this is great. And just to hear all the parts. So it was a real eye-opening production experience for all of us that were on there. So
I'll bet. Yeah.
Dave was the contractor on that. Dave was played bass on all of it. So, yeah,
gotta
give
cool.
a shout-out to my paisano buddy.
That's good. Hey, well, thank you so much for your time, John. You know, we've spent around an hour, and we've covered a lot of ground, and I think our audience is going to enjoy this. So everybody get out there and you listen to the Mutual Admiration Society. It's a great project, and I'm sure you know all the stuff that that John has worked on in the past. Thanks to Gordon, please. Thank you.
Yes, Gordon Rusfold. Thank you for engineering. Yeah.
And again,
he's right here. Yeah.
And again, thank you for being with us. It's we've had a great time.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, John.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you, Rick, and thank you, Eddie, again for staying on course to reach out to me. I'm glad we got around to this. It was really a lot of fun.
It was really fun. It was great.
Privilege and honor to be part of this.
All right. So, we'll be keeping touch, okay?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Special thanks to John Ferraro for joining us on this episode of Inside MusicCast. We'd also like to thank our correspondents, Brian Pearson, Kim Riley, Scott Gross, Mikhail Engstrom, Don Brightup, Scott Sheriff, Loretta Sassaman, Yinka Oyelese, and Arnaud Legere for the continued support and content development. Inside MusicCast is powered by Earshot Audio Post and Cabello Associates. Inside MusicCast Radio is back and is playing West Coast, AOR, jazz, pop, and funk, and is streaming now at InsideMusicCast.com, TuneIn, or download the free apps for iOS and Android devices. For Eddie Cabello, I'm Rick Such. Thanks for listening to Inside MusicCast and Inside MusicCast Radio.